Oborne and Heller on Cricket, brought to you by the Chiswick Calendar.
Hello, it's Richard Heller on a cold, damp morning in southeast London. Apologies from Peter, who's in the Middle East. We haven't been able to get a reliable hookup to him yet. Very grateful, as usual, to our friend Roger Alton for taking his place with the new ball at the pavilion end.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I'm in southeast London too, where it is dismal, but I'd be very interested to know who's going to win the Grand National, so any tips, very welcome.
I can give you a selection, and you can bet the field against it, Roger, if you want to. that's my luck on the turf. Yeah. We're very glad to have with us today, Roger, another old friend, Stephen Lynch, the international editor of Wisden, and responsible for a section which we visit a lot and which I think a lot of readers turn to first, the obituary section. I look at it first to see whether I'm in it, just in case. But it's, as usual, a rich and deserved tribute to cricketers all over the world. And we're very glad to have Stephen, its editor and compiler, with us to talk about it today.
Can I just say, I think it is absolutely fantastic. It's compulsive, and it's the range and variety, the wit, obviously, of the words, but just the sheer range of the people. It's absolutely mesmerising stuff. It's a treat. It's an absolute treat. Sorry to be so sycophantic, but it is a treat.
Well deserved.
Well, good morning. Thanks for that introduction, which is very kind. I'm also somewhere in London, and it's also not a very nice day, so it's much more exciting to be talking on here. Can't believe it's a year since we did this.
Well, it is another year gone by. Stephen, I counted the names this year. I think it was, and I got to 197, which I think is seems like a record to me. It just illustrates the sort of comprehensive nature of it. The names this year led by Her Majesty the late Queen. Tell us about the late Queen's connections with cricket, which were deeper than I'd thought.
Yes, she made several official visits to Lords, and Prince Philip, her late husband, was MCC's president twice, which probably increased the number of visits. But she was at the centenary test in Melbourne, and actually she was also, that there is a team on the Windsor estate that play, and she used to pop around and watch them sometimes, which was nice.
I don't imagine she was asked to do the teas.
Well, I expect they were very nice teas if you did. we knew there was another article up the front of the book about her, so the tribute in the obituaries is not very long. But then we had the problem of where she should go in it, and it seemed a bit retentive to put her under queue for Queen, so we put it up.
she's in the right place, yeah.
Well, I think so, yeah. I was at the Oval Test last year when actually the news came through, and then there wasn't any play on the second day. So that was perhaps her last connection with cricket. And then when the Test actually started against South Africa, they kicked off with God Save the King, which was perhaps not the very first rendition of it, but one of the first.
Indeed.
Yeah. Stephen, can I just ask one tiny thing? Which is this, it's just these are odd matches, which I found so exciting and taught me things I had no idea. For example, so you had Andy Gorham, the Scotland goalkeeper, and you've got Carmen Khalil, the sort of terrifying feminist publisher, yes. Both sitting here. And I just wonder if you could say a little bit about them, because they're just so unlikely.
Yes, well, Andy Gorham was one of these, if you're like me, a not very good player, rather annoying people who are very good at every sport. Yeah. And he was a pretty good cricketer, but obviously a very good footballer. And in these days, football plays 10 times as much. So these people play football rather than cricket. In the 50s, he'd possibly have played cricket more. And he did play for the Scottish national team, played against Australia and enraged Merv Hughes by batting without a helmet.
Really? Yeah.
The people in Scotland remember him as a good cricketer as well as a sort of almost a legendary goalkeeper.
Yeah. And what about Carmen Khalil?
Her connection mainly was that she was an Australian living in London mainly, and she had her, I think it was her 80th birthday or her 75th birthday party at Lord's. presumably in the long room. And somebody gently pointed out there was a World Cup football match on that day, so she arranged for a big screen.
Excellent.
She followed cricket as well.
Well,
we try. I mean, you obviously can't include everybody who's keen on cricket, but some people have an interesting angle that make it worth including.
Yeah.
How did she come to your notice, Stephen? She's not. I had no idea of her connection with cricket, I must say.
Obviously, we saw her obituary. I read something. I don't know if it's in The Guardian, by her friend Rachel Cook, and that talked about the cricket and the what a sort of force of nature she was. It was just an interesting addition.
Yeah.
Another one, in fact, right beside her alphabetically, was Professor David Butler, who's another in the category of famous people one didn't realise had a connection with cricket. In his case, it seems as though his appetite for political statistics may have derived from cricket. Is that right?
Apparently, yes. He's the chap who invented or co-invented the swingometer that we're probably familiar with from election coverage. He fronted election coverage on the BBC for years, or television for years. And apparently he started this by buying Wisden in the 1930s and memorising all the tables and averages in it. And then when war broke out, there weren't so many tables and averages, so he had to try something else. Then he started analysing election statistics, which perhaps has something in common with bowling averages.
Fantastic.
It is. And he produced regularly his own kind of political version of Wisden, for years, and he started it for years and for years and years. That was the almanac of, well, it was actually called the almanac of British politics.
Yeah, Nuffield, was it?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And which has a, just like, the county averages, it has a sort of analysis, not just of 18 counties and national counties, as they're now called, but it had an analysis of breakdown of results in 650 parliamentary constituencies. It was absolutely indispensable, as Wisden was.
One of the things that struck me is that if you made it past about 40, then you're highly likely to live well into your 90s, because the number of people, the ages of some of these people, is fantastic. And it's obviously the sort of, good living of cricket and life in the outdoors and the excellent cucumber sandwiches and all that. I was very struck by a couple of early women in your excellent thing. One, Nancy Haynes, who died at 95 and was, we think of sort of women's cricket, probably falsely, as a sort of relatively modern thing. But in fact, obviously, it's been going on for donkey's years. And Nancy Haynes was an Australian spinner, I think, was she? Her best figures are 9 for 43. And then Sheila Hill, who was 93 and an Australian, and a great administrator. And these are sort of people who've given their sort of life to cricket or done a great deal for cricket. For decades after decades after decades. It's terrific.
Yeah, I suppose it's a sort of healthy-ish lifestyle, so I suppose that might help. And there's an umpire in there who got to 102.
Yes.
There's sadly a few people, cricketers, who took their own lives. It seems to be that seems to come up every year. There are some examples of cricketers, famous and not so famous, who just...
Mark Hastings as well.
Yes, yep. Who perhaps can't cope with the emotional loss of the end of their career and losing their connection with cricket. But it's a sad thing that come. They're usually about, I notice, three or four every year. It's also a very sad case at the other end of the age spectrum. There's an Indian schoolboy, isn't there, of 16.
Ah, yes. He had presumably a heart attack or something on the field. I suppose you said there's 197 in there. I suppose there's going to be three or four that took their own life. We might not even know always, I suppose. And there's going to be the odd bad accident, I guess. It's just a sad fact.
It is.
The sad thing is packed with some of the biggest names in cricket are in your obits. Rod Marsh, Shane Warne, obviously Andrew Symons. English, Bunbury guy, Jim Parks. I mean, would you like to talk a little bit? I mean, about obviously the big names of Rod Marsh and Shane Warne, who died so close together, and I think was a sort of hammer blow to anybody who's loved cricket. And the both the obits in your section are superb. And Rod Marsh emerges a very thoughtful guy, and Shane Warne obviously is this epic figure for cricket, so tragically young. I mean, is there anything you'd like to say about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was just a stunning day. I think that Warne and Marsh were basically the same day. And one of the last things Warne did was tweet a tribute to Marsh, which we mentioned. Something I probably should say before we go much further is that I don't actually write all these myself. and that the Warne was actually written by Richard Hobson, who was his, ghostwriter for his autobiography, so knew him very well. I did do the Marsh, so you can blame me for that one.
No, they're both terrific.
We also have Matthew Engel does a few, and Richard Whitehead, who used to work for the Times, does a few as well. So I don't want to take all the credit.
Do you want to name, just as a little brackets question, I mean, will you ever start naming the people who write the major obits, for example? Do you think it's a good idea or not?
I think it has been talked about. I think the point is that they're supposed to be like the last word from Wisden. So I don't know if that might get in the way if you did that.
Going to Rodney Marsh and Shane Warne, Stephen, was there anything that surprised you in the tributes to them? Something that you hadn't been aware of? It really filled out, both of them, I thought, revealed a lot of, their personality that wasn't actually obvious to the public. But was there anything that particularly caught you by surprise in their lives?
I suppose with Marsh, you had this sort of idea, I guess, in your head that he was what they call in Australia a larrikin, a sort of what we might call a bit of a yob. and he wasn't really like that at all. It was a bit of an act, and he liked wine rather than beer, and he was very thoughtful, and he's a very deep thinker on cricket.
He could use the beer, though. There was a great anecdote in the piece about that he got through about 70 cans or whatever it was, and was taken off the plane when they arrived in England on a luggage trolley.
Yes, well, allegedly, I think.
Allegedly.
Yes.
That's a famous story. David Boone allegedly beat that.
Record.
But Marsh said he had a longer than allowed stopover in Dubai or something to recover. So he said he didn't really count.
So that's not going to appear in the records section, is it? A new
record section.
Yeah, yes.
It'd probably be like the Guinness Book of Records had to stop putting records like that in place.
They did, didn't they?
People got ill.
Quite right. Yes, that's right. Yep.
Well, I suppose the biggest name this year is Warne, with due respect to everybody else. And that was just shocking. I arrived in Australia on a visit the day of the memorial service, and I didn't really feel up to going, but I wish I had. Huge memorial service in Melbourne when they named the staff the big stand after him.
50,000 people, amazing.
Yeah. I just think his sort of love of cricket comes through somehow. He didn't mind helping people, other countries, whatever. I remember my son was born the same day as him. And during the last Ashes, I thought, it'd be nice if I could get him to sort of record a little message for Daniel. But he was always terribly busy and he was always hurtling around. And I thought, we'll do it. Maybe we can do it in the next Ashes series. And sadly, no, we can't.
Yeah.
You had a very strong bond with Abdul Qadir, Shane Warne, and I'd love to have been... I've heard descriptions of it, but from Abdul, but I'd love to have been at that dinner party where they bowled, they span the ball at each other along Abdul's carpet.
That's right.
For about 3 hours. Yep.
They sat on the mat or something.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Just exchanging grips. And, it's just one artist to another. Yep.
I thought the other thing that comes over is that he was actually a very skillful captain, because he knew. And thought about cricket such a lot, though of course he didn't do very much captaincy. I think he did a bit in the Indian Premier League, but not much for Hampshire and hardly anything for Australia. I wonder, why is that, do you think?
I think they were just scared of him in a way, that he was very controversial and probably wasn't seen to be the right person. But I think generally in Australia he's now seen as the best captain they never had.
The best captain they never had,
He captained in about I might be wrong here, captained about in about a dozen one-day internationals and won about 11 of them, I think. So but you could tell there's that famous bit of commentary when he was mic'd up. Was that in the Big Bash when he was bowling to McCullum? Mm. He was mic'd up and bowling to Brendan McCullum, who's now the England coach. And he was telling the commentators, well, I think he's going to do this, and I might just slip in a quicker one. And he slipped in a quicker one and bowled him leg stumps. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
It must be nice to be able to do that. I was always captivated by the sort of leg spin masterclasses he did on the television.
Weren't they fantastic? Yeah.
Well, they were fantastic. And as a very sub-worn leg spinner, it almost made you want to retire, that you just turn up and do this.
Yeah. So sad. That's extraordinarily sad, those two deaths at the same time, weren't they? I mean, and the other one I was very interested in was Andrew Symonds, again, a very troubled guy.
Yeah.
What was your view of him? Great piece, very good piece in the Obits. Great piece.
Well, yeah, and a very good player, probably didn't quite do himself full justice in tests, but very good
absolutely
player
not,
in one day. He was killed in a car accident, which, again, I suppose happens. We have Rudy Kurtzen in there as well, the old umpire. He was killed in a car accident. But Symonds, again, is somebody you just love to watch. And he was quite a decent commentator as well.
Yeah. But he couldn't really settle, could he, after playing cricket? And all the booze and personal problems and all issues. And a difficult life,
Yeah, so I suppose there are people like that in every sport, aren't there? Football and cricket, but...
What's a rather sad reference in Andrew Symonds's obituary that he couldn't cope with the kind of the corporate demands of modern cricketers, and the suggestion that if he'd had his career perhaps 20 or 30 years earlier, he'd have been given a lot more freedom.
Yeah, he was never happier than when going fishing. I think he was fined for missing a team meeting because he went fishing, but he said, "But look what I caught."
What was that dispute with Harbhajan Singh, the Indian spinner he had? He was basically in the right, I think. What was that again, Singh?
Well, yes, he was. He said he was racially abused by Harbhajan, who, not surprisingly, denied it. And I think that the general feeling was, I don't know what the truth was, because I don't suppose we'll ever get to the bottom of that, but I think Symonds felt he'd been hung out to dry a bit by the Australian board, who were a bit desperate to keep on the right side of India, so that they rolled over a bit and agreed that Harbhajan probably hadn't said it.
The claim was Harbhajan had abused Symonds.
Symonds thought he'd called him a monkey or something.
Yeah.
But whether he misunderstood or what, I don't suppose we'll ever know. he was probably...
Wasn't. But they made up afterwards, didn't they, eventually? Symonds and Harbhajan, it says. Yeah.
Yeah. They played together or certainly against each other in the IPL. The IPL is probably Symonds' best area, I would have thought. Sort of ideal for him.
Can I ask about another guy just briefly before I go back a bit, which is a guy who I can remember from when I was growing up, was always keeping wicket for England, Jim Parkes, who again died at a ripe old age. And, what was his life like, Jim Parkes? He's in his 90s, I think, when he died, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think he was England's oldest player when he died. He was 90-something.
Yeah.
Well, he's an interesting case because he played for England as a batsman very young in 1954. And then he was persuaded by Robin Marler, who's somebody else in the obituaries, to take up wicket-keeping and became England's wicket-keeper. And basically, on the fact that he was a pretty useful batsman, he's got at least one, possibly two test centuries. So he was one of the earliest cases of England selecting a wicketkeeper who perhaps wasn't the best keeper around, but would produce a few runs. And like you, I remember him being a bit of a fixture in the 60s.
Yeah.
There's a very, very good story about Keith Andrew, who was a better wicketkeeper than him, which has showed something very generous, a very generous spirit on Keith Andrew I think it was England's tour of the West Indies, wasn't it? When Parkes was flown in as an emergency and claimed the wicketkeeping spot from him, which would have been Keith Andrew's, wasn't it? Tell us a story about that.
Well, Andrew was the second keeper on that tour in, what was that, early 1960. So I think Roy Swetman was the first choice, and he wasn't making many runs. And so they, I think Parks was coaching in Trinidad or Guyana or something, and he was called in, and he scored 100 in the side game against Guyana or somebody. So they put him in for the test, and he scored 100 in that too. So, and he hadn't been keeping wicket for very long then. So he obviously wouldn't have been up to the standard of Andrew, who I think was generally considered probably one of the best wicketkeepers around, but the batting, his batting wasn't as good. So,
what was his later life like, Jim Parks's?
He was associated with Sussex, I think, right until the end. He was like a goodwill ambassador for Sussex. You often saw him around there.
Yeah.
I remember there was, I don't know when that would have been, the 70s or 80s, there was like an old England team, and Parks had quite a lot to do with that. He used to see elderly Fred Truman.
Yes.
I think he organised that old England team for a long time.
I think he worked for Whitbread, and they sponsored it.
I think that's right. And he refused to keep wicket again in his late his late days, didn't he?
He probably had enough.
Yeah, he went back to his original trade as a specialist batsman. Mm. Quite a lot of test players in the list, but one that caught my eye from roughly that era is Sonny Ramadan.
Oh, yeah.
Great bowler, absolutely brought low by that stand, wasn't he, between May and Cowdery, 1957.
Yeah, 411. And Ramadan bowled 98 overs, which is a record in that innings. Mm. And reckoned he had them LBW about 98 times, I think, but not given us.
They just went out and kicked the ball away?
They generally, they couldn't tell which way he was turning the ball. So they played him, I think, like an off-spinner and got the pad outside the line of the stumps and kicked it away. And the umpires were not going to give it out at that point.
Right.
Johnny Wardle, who's a fellow spinner, had a great sympathy for him in that ordeal, didn't he? In that ordeal of 98 overs.
Yes, I think they all thought that he got quite a few wickets and wasn't given, and he was never quite the same again. He played in England for a while, played for Lancashire for a bit, so he came and lived here.
He did.
But 98 overs, I mean, it's like equivalent to the sort of bowling non-stop, I mean, apart from changing it, but for 2 days, isn't it, effectively, 98 overs.
Yeah.
And that continually without a single break. It's just impossible to imagine what the state of his fingers and arm and shoulder would have been. You know, well, did he say anything about it? Like, for Christ's sake, don't do that again. You know, I mean, what did he say afterwards? Do you know? I think it's an amazing story, that 98 overs.
I'm not sure. He didn't. I always thought there should be a book about Ramadan, but there hasn't been one yet. I'm not actually sure what he thought. I do think he probably thought he got rather more than 2 for 179, which is what he finished up with.
Is that what it was? Yeah. And yes. Was there then a change in the LBW law as a result of that?
I'm not sure when the change was. You can now be given out if you're not playing shot.
Yeah.
It came to, as I remember, it came directly off. Well, it came the year after that innings.
Really?
It had just. And you can now be. May and Cowdery were able to profit from the fact that you could not be given out if the ball hit you outside the off stump. That was it. It had to be wicket. It had to hit you in front of the wicket, in front of the stumps. And now you can't. You can't do it. Batsmen have been complaining about that, I think, ever since. But I'm pretty sure it was after that innings, which sort of showed that technique to the world.
Yeah, it may well have been. I'm not absolutely sure, but I think it was after this, and possibly, you're probably right, not very long after.
Great man. How old is he when he died? 92. You see, another, I see, I'm right, basically. They all lived to a ripe old age.
This is a Richard Whitehead one. He spoke to him the previous year, spoke to Ramadan about Everton Weeks a couple of years ago when Weeks died. Yeah. Sort of was like going, sort of jumping in the TARDIS and going back in time to talk to someone who played in tests in 1950. And
yes.
And then he was still alive and living in Blackburn or wherever it was. It was just a bit.
But I think in Richard's piece about Sonny Ramadan, I mean, so he was brought up, came from a very poor background. he was given this name Sonny because he was sort of smiley, but it was the only name he ever knew. He didn't know what his name was, didn't know much about cricket, but was a brilliant player. Hadn't heard of any of England's batsmen, so he must have been particularly annoyed when May and Cowdrey forced him to grind on day after day. But it's just a fascinating, lovable character. I think you're right. I mean, it would be a marvellous book, wouldn't it? Ramadan and Valentine.
Yeah, I think one for the list.
It is. There's so many fascinating obituaries in this year's list, as in previous years, Stephen. And I just wondered, how do you go about preparing them? Obviously, you know, some names come up, you know, by surprise and shock, like Shane Warne's, but others Roger's been talking about have been, well, around a long time, have lived into their 90s. Is there any effort to sort of prepare discreetly for the deaths of elderly cricketers and to discover new information about them and even to try and interview them before it's too late?
Not really. I suppose you're aware that people are in their late 80s and you might be thinking about it a bit. Usually we wait until the sad news comes through, I think,
right.
and then we wonder, because we're lucky, not like a newspaper that has to produce it the next day or something. We've got usually a few months to think about it. So we talked about how we would treat Shane Warne, and we came up with a writer for that one, which is unusual. We don't normally farm the obituaries out, but that seemed a sensible one. The smaller ones, I tend to see what they did and try and find out a bit more about them. The internet, I don't know how anybody wrote an obituary without the internet, but
If you go to Wisden HQ, if I wandered around, is there a sort of filing cabinet with a whole heap of names? Caps are not dead yet or something, and then or heading for the fifth floor, heading for the upper floor, and then sort of waiting to be updated or not. I get the impression that's not the case.
No, that's not really the case. I think we had that for Bradman, and it was lucky they did, because he Bradman passed away just about in press time. So I suppose that's the nightmare for Wisden, but we have, so we cover the last year, so we've got usually a bit of time to think about it. But as you say, there's quite a lot of them, so I try and keep them up to date. With the smaller type people, you try and find one or two unusual and interesting facts.
You
don't just want to say he played 10 matches and scored. His high score was 74. You want to know that there's somebody in there who was fielding through Hanif Mohammed's 499. There's somebody.
Yes. It's absolutely brilliant. Yeah. So how do you find those facts? Fielding through 499. How did you find that out? Diligent research.
Oh, very diligent. Yes. the sort of starting point is that there are two sort of very scholarly cricket websites, Cricinfo and Cricket Archive, and they both maintain a list of players they've heard that have died during the year. So I start with that, and then you have a look at the matches that these people played in, and sometimes I think, well, obviously he played against that touring team, and wonder what he did, and you have a look, and he got such and such a wicket. There's I don't know if you spotted him. There's a Australian politician called Tony Street.
Tell me about him. What happened?
I've been saving this one up for years. He was a Liberal MP. I think he was a cabinet minister in Australia, but he also played against the South Africans in 1952-3, got a couple of wickets. But many years ago, when I worked for MCC, Tony Street was a member, and the overseas membership was £1. But for some reason, his bank paid £100, which was like a ridiculous amount. And they paid it for at least a couple of years. So I think there's a fact in there that nobody else will know, because I had to refund him 99 quid.
Can I ask you about, you talk about Crick Info. Isn't there a fascinating Crick Info guy in your obits this week? He died very young. Would you like to talk about him, Travis Basavi?
Basavi, yes. He's. I used to work with him because I was editor of Crick Info, and he was astonishing. He Crick Info works now basically because of what he did. He set up the content system. So you put something in and it appears on your screen. And he also invented, because he liked that sort of thing, to answer queries he had, he invented StatsGuru, which you may be familiar with. You can query it. You can go and look at Shane Warne's record against India or Pakistan or England or whoever. And he just dreamt that up out of his head. He was a self-taught programmer. And it's just an astonishing thing.
He's one of the most influential people in the modern game, Travis Basavi. I bet you nobody's heard of him. Really.
Well, yes, he's probably the most influential person you've never heard of. He went on to work for CrickViz after he finally left CrickInfo. He was also one of the early people on CrickInfo who did their ball by ball commentary, which is probably their most famous feature, I should think. And he went on to CrickViz, and I think he invented their win predictor that you see quite a lot of on the television now, that says Kolkata Knight Riders are 75% sure of winning or something. And he like I say, he was self-taught. He was very approachable, liked a beer. It's just a big tragedy. He was only 47.
Extraordinary, terrible sadness. So it was just, he was a brilliant programmer, is that right? Brilliant programmer and had great creativity about cricket and stats and all these things that make cricket what it is, particularly the modern game. Was it that he just loved the game, did he?
Yes, yeah. He started out from that point of view, probably not even being paid anything by CrickInfo, just doing the ball by ball commentary, and then they signed him up, and he produced, as I say, the Stats Guru and the content system. He said, it says here, just came from being a cricket fan and knowing what kind of things I'd like to see.
Yeah.
And I do the Ask Stephen column, and he used to help with that. I'd say to him, somebody's asked who, how many people have scored 47 on a second innings of a run chase or something, and he would produce it. And I never knew how.
I mean, he's sort of worth more. I mean, you've got given him a lovely little obit here, but he's sort of one of those people you'd like to read more about because of his influence on the game by Crick Info.
Crick Info did quite a lot at the time when he passed away.
Yeah. Was he ever married, out of interest?
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
He had quite a young child, unfortunately.
Lovely. Great man.
Yeah.
We mentioned briefly earlier, Stephen, David English was one of the big personalities in this year's list. Sadly lost him. He was known as the Loon, and the other big personality we've touched on briefly was Robin Marler, who was known as Mad Marler. Tell us a bit about them, and in particular, there's some great stories about both of them. I love the one about David English getting a cricket match by accident into the footage of A Bridge Too Far. How did that go happen?
He always claimed to have taught Robert Redford how to play cricket, I think. And there would obviously be long gaps in filming, a big thing like that. And he was a private or something in the film. He was an actor, just to explain what he was doing there. And at some point they had a very expensive scene done, and then when they looked back at the rushes the next morning or evening, they spotted the game of cricket was being played in the corner of the screen, and they had to shoot it all again. Must have made him terribly popular. He was larger than life doesn't really do him justice. He was sort of just an amazing personality, a personality who you couldn't look away from almost.
On his record, an extraordinary promoter of young cricket talent, wasn't he? I mean, I saw the statistic, 100 test players pass through. Was it 100 test players pass through his Bunbury Festival?
Yeah, he took over the festival. He wrote these Bunbury books, which people might know, which were sort of cartoon characters based on cricket. And he took on this under-15 England cricket festival, which wasn't doing very well, and turned it into the Bunbury Festival. And and it's just produced player after player. All the good young players of the age group come together and get to know each other. And as you say, hundreds of county players and lots of England players too.
And let's turn to Matt Marlowe for a minute. Another person with a much more sort of varied life than I'd realised. And I love the story about him sort of just disappearing from, you know, reporting cricket, you know, to attend to his business, or, you know, in the most extraordinary way. And then, you know, just coming back and reporting England on tour as if nothing had happened. Tell us a bit about that.
He wrote mainly for the Sunday Times, which meant that he would presumably have to file on a Friday or Saturday, so he could do whatever he liked during the rest of the week. There was one West Indian tour where he would come back to London during the week and work, and then go back to the West Indies on the Saturday and watch the game and file the report. It's amazing.
Because he was running a sort of full-time business on the side, wasn't he? He was running a recruitment business.
Yeah, sort of headhunting business.
Yeah.
I think he was a political candidate at least once.
Three times.
Oh, three times. Yep. Oh, right.
I've got it in front of me here. It's three times. Twice for the Conservative Party in completely unwinnable seats. I don't suppose that, you know, the amateur captain of Sussex went down terribly well in Bolsover, which was later won by Dennis Skinner. Once for the Referendum Party, you know, the anti-Jimmy Goldsmith's anti-EU party.
Yeah, right. He was also a considerable bowler. I think I was slightly surprised by the figures of his career as a cricketer. He couldn't have been very far off playing for England, but he was an off-spinner at the time of Jim Laker, which didn't help. But his figures really are quite impressive.
They were. Yeah. I've got it in here again in front of me. Twice took 15 wickets in a match for Sussex, for his county. Yeah. I can't resist saying that in that statistical breakdown of great Sussex bowlers, there is an astonishing name. I don't know if you can say anything about him, Stephen. It's very, perhaps a bit unfair, but do you know anything about J-E-B-B-P-Q-C Dwyer? Can you take us through all his initials?
Weirdly, I can, because I've just done next week's Ask Stephen, and he's in it. So it's very handy that you asked. He was something like John Elicious something Placidus Carrington Dwyer, something like that. He was on scorecards, he was usually EB, presumably to save ink or the scorer. Yeah. He was Australian, and he was somehow related to an Irish, there's an Irish sort of early Irish activist called Dwyer. He was somehow related to him, and he appeared in England, did very well for Sussex, but died very early. I think he died aged about 36. But yes, he's E.B. Dwyer. If you find an old scorecard, he'd probably be E.B.
Can I just say on that, what you were saying about Robin Marlowe and nipping back to London to do some work in the week before going out to report the cricket match on the Saturday for a Sunday paper, as he was cricket correspondent on the Sunday Times. This is so far from the world that we live in now. It's almost impossible. It's like sort of, you know, the mid-Victorian era or something, because now obviously cricket correspondents are writing a lot every day, wherever they are, for the website, probably a Sunday paper and a daily paper simultaneously. It's sort of just inconceivable, that kind of thing. And it sort of makes you respect the writers of today so much more, because they are doing such extraordinary amounts, rather than just as excellent as Robin Marlowe was, getting paid a fairly handsome wage for a few words once a week.
I'd agree with that. The early press boxes I went into just sort of got quiet after tea time when everybody started working. But now, as you say, they're working from the start. They're doing running updates. They're doing goodness knows what.
It's extraordinary.
It's terribly impressive when you actually see them in action.
It's unbelievably impressive. But the sort of modern day cricket journalists for newspapers, broadcasters as well. It's fantastic what they do, I think. And people assume it's just sort of happens by accident, but actually it's all by dint of extreme hard work. But they're still alive, so you won't be obituarizing them.
Not just yet.
As always, Stephen, there's some great human interest stories behind the obituaries. One that sort of caught my eye was Anjan Bhattachary, who overcame what must have been a significant handicap in Indian cricket, didn't he?
Yes, he was deaf and mute. But he, on his debut, got 6 wickets on the morning of his debut and did pretty well. He played for Bihar, I think, which is now called Jharkhand. And, yeah, I mean, overcame something you wouldn't think could really be overcome for cricket, really.
It's quite a handicap. It would be obviously a bit of a... I can't help wondering how he appealed. Presumably he had some sort of... they must have made some sort of allowances for him. And how did he hear a call when he was batting for... and so on.
I don't know. You probably had to be more demonstrative than normal.
Probably didn't. A great tribute to him to have played, and he got an award in India for his services to disability cricket in India, didn't he?
Yeah.
Another thing. Right,
so, go on. So, no, I was going to. I thought the. The 97-year-old judge who died last summer, he advised Rifkin to buy the railway tunnels under Lords and created this, which a long dispute with the MCC. I think Rifkin should have won it, but it is very, very interesting. Can you say something about him? When did you find Putsman? How do you know about Putsman?
I think he was in the... one of the newspapers, probably the Times or the Telegraph. We obviously look at those, and every now and then there's a mention of cricket somewhere. Perhaps the Rifkind was in one of those obituaries. I like the bit about he once shot himself with his own machine gun as well, which is
it's absolutely quite achievement. Yeah, not something to laugh about at all.
Yeah, isn't it? Oberon Waugh had a rather similar accident, didn't he, in National Service in Cyprus. I seem to remember he nearly... did he kill himself?
Where are we at with those disused tunnels now? What's the current state of play? Does anybody know? I mean, it's quite interesting. It was used as a device to develop the nursery and develop Laws by owning the tunnel. But I'm not sure where we're at with that. Has Rifkin pulled back?
Well, I think there's still a standoff. We had Charles Sale, who wrote a book about the whole thing the podcast some months back. And I think there's still a standoff, but it led, they still won't talk to Mr. Rifkin, and it led to the sale of life memberships at Lord's instead, you know, to raise the money that Mr. Rifkin might have given them.
Yeah, yeah. It is extraordinary. What do you feel about the Rifkin plan to develop the nursery end? Does anybody feel, or indeed give tuppence about it? I think the objection is that prison wall, that long prison wall, for anybody who knows Lords, that runs up Wellington Road for 200 or 300 yards and does look like a prison wall. And so somehow that is there rather than giving you some kind of insight, you know, look into Lords and the sort of HQ of cricket. I thought that was always a much better idea rather than that blooming wall.
I hadn't thought about that. I hadn't heard it. I hadn't heard anything about... I haven't heard an update for ages and ages. I heard your podcast, and that's probably the last I heard about it. Haven't MCC done some odd development thing to stymie it?
Yeah, I think so. That's quite what it is.
I can't quite remember what it is, but basically there's still... You know, yes, they're still not on speaking terms, I think. Yeah. And they'll do it... They will do anything to stymie Mr. Rifkind, who still owns the tunnels, doesn't he? I mean, he still owns them. But another lawyer who caught my eye in the obituaries, had a very big influence on cricket, was Mr. Justice Slade. Tell us about him, Stephen. He was a cricket lover, but he had to give a decision. He had to give a very, very important decision about cricket, didn't he?
Yes, he was the judge in the case brought by the players who'd signed for Kerry Packer for restraint of trade because England, or, well, ICC and the English cricket had banned them. And they sort of walked off with it. And they were well and truly stuffed, said Doug Insole, who was the TCCB chairman. So they were allowed to play. They were going to be, the people like Dennis Amos and Tony Greg were going to be banned from county cricket for signing for Packer, and they weren't allowed to ban them. You could not select them for England because that's a different thing, but you couldn't ban them from actually plying their trade.
Indeed.
One of my favourite county cricketers of all time was Dave Podmore, the the man who earned the number 12 berth in his county.
Yes.
So he was a satirical character, a satire of Andrew Nichols and Christopher Douglas. And Nichols sadly died at the age of 73. And there was a wonderful character, Dave Podmore. Yeah. Do you want to, can you say anything about him?
Yeah, well, as you say, Andrew Nichols was the reason we're talking about him. He died in November. Yes, well, Pod was the sort of archetypal county pro, wasn't he? Trying to average 23 a year and keep his contract, that sort of thing. It was very... I think it hit home with some people because they were doing it. But a clever creation.
In later life, I think he took up opening motor franchises in the East Midlands, or the ceremony opening and things like that. Somebody's
almost certainly, yeah.
But he got he was given a very important post by the Australian Cricket Board, wasn't he?
I don't remember that.
Yes, he was given the post of sledging coach to the Australian team. Yeah. So it says in Nichols's obituary, Podmore we haven't seen in the obituaries, which prompts me to ask Stephen, has anybody ever tried to slip a fake into the obituaries? And have you ever had to weed somebody out, an imaginary cricketer?
Not that I know of, although we may have to now if anybody's listening. No, I don't think so. We get a few letters and emails from people saying you might want to include my father or whoever it is. And we would have a look and see whether they were sort of, well, worth including. That sounds a bit harsh, but we can't include everybody who's ever played quite a lot of club cricket, for example. So you have to gently let them down sometimes. But I think that most of the people we include would be known to somebody or other. So
always interesting to read about people less well known, for example, two Mr. Clarks who were scorers and stewards appear in there, and it must have given a great deal of pleasure and pride to their families, loved ones, to see them there. But Stephen, what's the criteria the selection criteria for the obituaries? Rather a grim thing to say, but what's the selection criteria for the obituary section? Who?
I don't think there's not sort of hard and fast rules, but we try and include everybody that we know about or told about who played first-class cricket. So that's the starting point. But as you say, there are lots of associated people. The Ted Clark you're talking about was pavilion steward at Lord's for years and years, would be known by huge amounts of MCC members, Middlesex members, and anyone who'd been in the pavilion. Somebody said that if you hadn't been told off by him, you hadn't really been in the pavilion. But he did it with a sort of a twinkle, so he was very popular. So it's the county websites put up a lot of sort of what you might call fringe candidates. So there's the Leicestershire scoreboard operator, again, would have been known to quite a lot of people and quite a good story, once stood in as an umpire. So it's the starting point is that they played first class cricket, and then it's people who are fairly well connected or obviously connected with cricket. Might not have been a first class player, but were quite well known, I suppose, in cricket circles.
You've had this policy, Stephen, of covering women who retrospectively who ought to have received an obituary in Wisden. And this year's candidate is perhaps a little unusual in that category. It's Queen Victoria. Tell us about her connections with cricket.
Well, she was chosen to balance Queen Elizabeth as well. As you say, this feature has been going for 5 or 6 years now. We had a feeling that women were underdone in the past in Wisden. So we're trying to pick out a notable one that wasn't mentioned in Wisden at the time. And Wisden 1902 didn't do very much on Queen Victoria. she apparently asked to be kept informed of the details of the ashes in 1895, which was the first great series that first great five match series that happened. England won it 3-2, and they're just a big name that Wisden didn't
go
pay much attention to.
As it said, it mentions her grandson, Prince Christian Victor. So far, the only member of the royal family to have played first-class cricket.
So Isengari, in the days when they played first-class games.
I can add the detail to that he scored a double century in India, not a first-class one, at Rawalpindi for his regiment. There's a monument to it. Yep, there's a monument to it. We are running out of time, but I would like to bring in Colonel Don Beard, if I may. Another really interesting story, with a story within it, Stephen, was Colonel Don Beard. Interesting story in his own right. He was a veteran of Korea as a doctor, became doctor to, I think, the medical advisor to the Australian Cricket Board. But within that, within his obituary, is an absolutely riveting glimpse of Don Bradman, age 70. still playing cricket and facing a very fast bowler. Tell us about that one.
Don Beard was, if you remember Rick McCosker breaking his jaw in the centenary test, Don Beard was the medical gent who helped him off the pitch. And it was the following year when India were touring Australia. Beard, who was friendly with Bradman, had invited a few people for dinner. And Bradman was persuaded to have a bat in the net that Beard had set up in his back garden for his children. His children were sort of teenage, aspiring fast bowlers. And Bradman was batting against them, just with no protective equipment, just a bat. And Geoff Thompson turned up for dinner. And he said, "If Bradman's batting, I'm bowling." And he went out and just sort of sent a few down, and Bradman dispatched him a bit, so he speeded up. I don't think you'd really want to be facing Tomo in street shoes and trousers and no box. And eventually Tomo thought he might kill Bradman, so he stopped. But he just stood there and watched as these teenagers, who weren't so worried about killing Bradman, tried to bowl to him. And he said, "It was the most amazing batting I've ever seen. It was seaming all over the place. These youngsters were operating at around Glenn McGrath's pace. And Bradman didn't play a full shot in 20 minutes.
Wow.
It's a fantastic insight into Bradman. Yeah. I thought that little story is absolutely fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah.
He said, "I don't care if they were former Test batsmen. Any other bloke of 70 wouldn't have hit a ball, not one ball." Mm. That got him in, because we weren't sure that he qualified otherwise. And then I found this.
Well, 100%. That's one of the best stories about Bradman. That joke when people say to old cricketers now, like, Viv Richards, "How would you get on against so-and-so?" And he said, "Well, I'm pretty much there. Oh, don't forget, I am 60. And in fact, so with old Bradman, he could have done it, and he was 70. It's fantastic.
I think there's another quote which didn't make it. Tomo sort of said, "Well, why isn't this bloke playing for us tomorrow?"
Yeah.
Probably could have done. Well, we'd better wrap up. Stephen, another sad but rich parade of obituaries and wisdom this year for us to look at. Lots and lots of great stories and human interest in it. Wonderfully written and edited, as usual. Thank you very much for joining us once again.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Yeah, I can't wait to get the book. Marvellous stuff, Stephen. Joy to read. Joy. Sad. There we are.
On which note, it has to be goodbye from me, Richard Heller. It's brightened up a little bit in my bit of South East London.
And goodbye from me, Roger Orton, too. Bye. Thanks very much indeed, Stephen. It's terrific.